President Trump and I are appreciative that once again you have answered the call to serve America and advance the interests of the people of this country. Your leadership and your experience will serve well as the Secretary of Transportation, overseeing what we anticipate will be historic investments in our nation's roads, bridges, airports, and above all, in our future. It is my great privilege to welcome America's new Secretary of the Department of Transportation, Elaine Chao.
Today, I am keeping another promise to the American people by nominating Judge Neil Gorsuch of the United States Supreme Court to be of the United States Supreme Court.
When we judges don our robes, it doesn't make us any smarter, but it does serve as a reminder of what's expected of us. Impartiality and independence, collegiality and courage. As this process now moves to the Senate, I look forward to speaking with members from both sides of the aisle, to answering their questions and to hearing their concerns. I consider the United States Senate the greatest deliberative body in the world, and I respect the important role the Constitution affords it in the confirmation of our judges.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Today is, well, the first day of February. Welcome to it. It's February 1st, 2017, 5:11 in the morning. Glad to have you along for another edition of The Opening Bell, another business day, another business month. Lots to talk about today. We'll be talking about the Federal Reserve in just a few minutes. A little bit later on in the program, we're going to be talking about the rise of the herbal tea party. What is that, you say? You'll find out coming up about 5:35 here on The Opening Bell. Right now, let's check the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning. Dow futures are positive, up about 41 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures are higher as well. Crude oil is trading up just a few ticks as well. In Europe, markets generally higher this morning. FTSE up, DAX up about 110 points, almost a full percent. The CAC in France up a little more than a percent as well, as European markets seem to be coming back from a few days of negative returns there. Asian shares mostly higher, lifted on upbeat manufacturing data from China and Japan. The U.S. dollar steady, regaining some lost ground after falling on comments by President Trump accusing China and Japan of manipulating their currencies. The Nikkei rose about to 0.5%. The Kospi in South Korea jumped about 0.5% as well. On Wall Street, U.S. stocks fought their way back to a mixed finish as drug makers rallied, which mostly canceled out losses for industrial companies yesterday. Investors shifted their money to less risky investments for a second day in a row. The Dow Jones Industrial sank about 107 points. Some news while you slept. Germany's BMW will stick with its investment plan for Mexico and the United States, despite warnings from President Trump to impose border taxes on cars imported into the United States. This is according to the CEO of the luxury car maker today. He says we need free world trade. Chief Executive Harald Kruger told an automotive congress, an automotive congress in Germany today, adding that the BMW would also continue to invest in its U.S. Spartanburg plant. In London, the British House of Commons is set to vote on a bill authorizing Prime Minister Theresa May to start European Union exit talks, the first major test of whether lawmakers will try to impede the government's Brexit plans. The vote comes just 2 days, comes after 2 days of debate, in which many government and opposition leaders said they would respect voters' June 23rd decision to leave the European Union, and they would signal their willingness to support that bill. Federal Reserve policymakers are putting markets on notice that the central bank's $4.5 trillion balance sheet is back on the agenda in an apparent effort to give investors time to prepare for changes. Rather than signal any action is imminent, policymakers want to minimize any volatility that might be slimming the Fed's massive balance sheet, and they have said they will only do so after interest rate increases are well underway. Central Bank is holding 2 days of meeting, wrapping up today. Joining us now live this morning is Greg McBride. He is CFA, a Senior Vice President, Chief Analyst at Bankrate.com. Greg, good morning. Welcome back to The Opening Bell.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you on. So what is the Federal Reserve setting us up for here?
Well, you know, you mentioned, about the balance sheet, and I think that's, another element that will come into play throughout the year, kind of some hints on that front. And the more immediate offing for the Fed is, what are they going to do next with interest rates, and when are they going to do it? Of course, they just raised rates at their last meeting in December, so there's not a rate hike in the cards for today. But everybody's going to be sort of gauging what's their assessment of the economy and what might that portend for interest rate hikes down the road. I think the Fed kind of is going to take a middle-of-the-road tact here with regard to leaving their options open on both sides. There's just a lot of uncertainty right now with regard to fiscal policy. They want to buy themselves some time to sit back and see how that unfolds before they commit themselves to another interest rate hike.
Well, I know there's generally some business bookmaking, a term there, not actual bookmaking, that goes on about when we might see increases. What is the crystal ball telling us?
Well, the futures market seems to indicate June as the time frame for the next rate hike. Now, of course, that's subject to change one way or the other. If we saw inflation picking up, for example, I doubt we'll see it, but if we got a very quick resolution in terms of when we were going to get fiscal stimulus and there was legislation passed, that could move up the timetable a little bit. On the other side, if we saw the economy stumble or something like that, if there was volatility in global financial markets, maybe even due to an event overseas, that could keep the Fed on the sidelines. So, I mean, when the Fed says that they are meeting to meeting, that's literally the case. I mean, it really kind of depends on, how things are sitting at one particular meeting as to whether or not they're going to raise interest rates or if they're going to punt and, wait till the next one.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now, stocks clawed their way to a mixed finish on Tuesday with drug companies rallying before the close. The Dow lost 107 points to finish at 19,864. The S&P 500 lost 2 points, but the Nasdaq gained one. Two luxury electric vehicles, the Tesla Model S and the BMW i3, missed out on the highest safety ratings in crash tests from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. The Institute's top safety pick award is given to vehicles that get the highest rating in 5 tests and offer crash prevention systems. The Southwest Airlines website was hit with a slowdown yesterday. It wasn't a major issue and didn't affect the ability to check in passengers, but it did mark the third technical glitch for a major U.S. airline in the past week. If you're in the market for a new television, you could find a better deal this week than you would have found on Black Friday. The 2 weeks leading up to the Super Bowl typically yield the lowest prices on high-quality TV sets as retailers clear out space for newer models. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
It's 522. Welcome back to the program. We're on with Greg McBride this morning from Bankrate.com. He's the Senior Vice President, Chief Analyst at Bankrate, talking about the Fed. And, Greg, as we continue this conversation, I'm interested to know what it is that the Fed will be looking for as it moves forward in this year from the Trump administration. What economic factors will weigh into what they decide?
Well, the big picture things for the Fed are, continued economic growth, job growth. The one thing that they really kind of pinned their hopes on last year, and it really kind of became the linchpin, I think, for the December rate hike, was wage growth. We finally started to see that. I think that was what tipped the scales for the Fed to be comfortable to raise rates at the end of last year. So I think those are the big picture items. But I think the wild card this year is going to be inflation, just because the numbers are going to look a little bit different this year than what we've seen in years past. We've lost that favorable year-over-year comparison on oil prices that had depressed the inflation numbers for so long. Even the core inflation that excludes food and energy has been moving higher. It's been moving closer to that 2% target that the Fed has set out. And then you layer the potential for fiscal stimulus on top of what's already a job market that's near full employment. Yeah, again, I think inflation will be the one that's really worth watching. If it materializes sooner or faster than expected, that could be something that forces the Fed's hand at some point later this year, forcing them to act maybe a little bit more aggressively than they otherwise would.
I've seen a couple of estimates and predictions about inflation in terms of how quickly and how much it might go up this year. What are you thinking?
Well, I mean, I do think it's, the one that could kind of sneak up on us if we're not mindful of it. So, I mean, we definitely have to watch it. Like I said, I think it's going to be the wild card. It's been a long time, Steve, since we've really had to pay attention to inflation releases. And I think that changes in 2017. I think as the year progresses, I think that's one of the economic releases every month that, you know, markets are going to have their eye on the economic calendar.
You know, in the last round of Fed governors and presidents out doing their speeches, and even Janet Yellen to a certain extent, suggested they wanted to see more details from Donald Trump about his plans, that it was getting to the stage where the, you know, economists and investors want to see what he's going to do. Is it about time that we do see some of those specifics, and are they coming, do you think?
Well, I mean, yes, they're coming, and yes, I mean, Janet Yellen and financial markets and all the rest of us are kind of waiting on the details, and here's why. Because markets have rallied significantly since Election Day based on this expectation that we are going to get infrastructure spending, tax cuts, repatriation of cash from overseas, those kind of stimulus measures, but it's been based on the speculation, not concrete specifics. Well, you know, at some point, markets are going to be in this, you know, show me the money mode, right, where they're going to want to see specifics. And the risk that we have after this big run up in the markets, which I think has kind of been based on best case scenario, is that if the reality doesn't match up to the expectations, markets are going to be primed for a correction. So and all of that factors into the Fed's decision making, because, you know, in terms of gauging the amount of stimulus, that's going to be very helpful for them in sort of gauging the path of the economy going forward. It's also going to be a factor in inflation going forward. And if there's any kind of disappointment, you know, anything that unsettles markets, that could be something that influences the Fed and causes them to stay on the sidelines a little bit longer. So, yeah, I think, the devil's in the details. It could be a catalyst either for volatility or, you know, a catalyst to, continue to push markets and the economy forward.
Interesting that you say that this is based on the best case scenario, what we're seeing on the markets. You're not the first person I've heard say that in recent days after looking at the Dow and other market performance over the last week or so. Is this maybe the beginning of our correction? Is the Trump trade over?
No, but I think what you're seeing is that there is starting to get a little bit of skepticism about, like, well, we're kind of short on specifics here. And wait a minute, you know, as the year progresses, by the time this legislation gets passed, this might not be money that hits the economy in 2017. It might be in 2018. So I think you're seeing this investors almost sort of second guessing themselves in a way. And again, that's where I said about the reality not matching up to the expectations. I think that's our risk in terms of, or one of the key risks that we have in the market over the next few months is as these details come out, do they match up to that, what I think is a best case scenario that markets have already priced in?
And in the meantime, for all of the rest of us, we should probably take the Fed at its word this year in terms of preparing for these Fed increases, these rate increases coming, maybe refinance if we haven't done it already. What would your other advice be?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, we can debate whether or not they're going to raise rates three times or not. I'm a little skeptical about three. But the fact is, yeah, we all signs point toward the Fed continuing to raise interest rates. So get out of that adjustable rate mortgage, look at refinancing into something that's more suitable to your timetable and offers a predictable monthly payment. Pay down that credit card debt or transfer the balance to one of those 0% or other low rate offers so that you give yourself a window of debt repayment. You know, a lot of people have been lugging these home equity line of credit balances around over the last 10 years or so when interest rates were really low. But as the Fed raises rates, the interest rate on that home equity balance is also going to go up. So have a game plan for how you're going to pay that down. You don't want to be lugging that same balance into a higher interest rate environment over the course of the next few years.
Greg, always good chatting with you. Thanks for being with us here on the Opening Bell.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Greg McBride is the Senior Vice President, Chief Analyst at Bankrate.com. You can follow him on Twitter at BankrateGreg, and also you can follow Bankrate on Twitter at Bankrate.
From ABC News, Tech Trends. Cyber attacks are on the rise, and adversaries have more tools than ever before. Cisco Systems is out with its annual cybersecurity report card, showing an explosive growth in potential targets for hackers. The report also finds nearly a third of businesses have lost revenue because of cybersecurity breaches, and one in five have lost customers in the process.
We've got to start measuring the impacts of this and make sure that we get very aggressive together, as a world.
John Stewart is Chief Security and Trust Officer with Cisco. He says criminals are increasingly moving away from stealing customer information and are deleting it instead.
If you're not stealing information, you're not stealing credit cards, you're not essentially doing a denial of service, you're causing computing data centers to be erased.
Stewart says if we're going to meet these new challenges, we need to create new tools and work toward training a new crop of qualified security professionals.
We are not generating enough graduates. We're not generating and have enough experienced professionals.
With Tech Trends, I'm Karen Chase, ABC News.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the program at 538. Glad to have you along for our first edition in February. We have lots going on this morning. Among that, we're watching politics in Washington. Will there be a new Tea Party arise out of the latest politics, political posturing, political activism that's going on around the country? We thought we'd bring in Washington Bureau Chief David Rennie, who's been writing about this, and he is with us this morning from Brussels, so you're going to hear a little bit of delay. We apologize in advance for that. But David, good morning.
Good morning.
Let me ask you about this, because you know, this notion of an herbal Tea Party comes from where and why?
Well, I think a lot of people on the left who are trying to work out how to respond to Donald Trump, and to be blunt, to resist Donald Trump, as they would see it, they point to things like the amazing energy you've seen with the Women's March the day after his inauguration, and then the protests that you have seen at American airports for several days after the travel ban. And they say that level of energy and enthusiasm suggests that a very large number of Americans are very fired up and think that Donald Trump's ideas are so dangerous that they should be resisted at every turn. And as soon as you see very large numbers of ordinary citizens coming out and marching in a kind of total rejection of a new president's agenda, obviously everyone is reminded of those huge conservative protests we saw when the Tea Party sprang to life in the first few years of Barack Obama's time as president. So the idea on the left is really, is that, could you do something as ambitious and powerful as the right did? And should the left copy that tactic of basically total obstructionism and total rejection of the sort of legitimacy of the president's agenda? Because some people are saying, look, you know, whether you liked it or not in terms of, you know, making the government gridlocked, it was fantastically effective politically.
You write in The Economist, by the way, we should mention you're the Washington Bureau Chief of The Economist. I left that out. I apologize. But the story is, it offers really sort of a roadmap for the Democrats to do this. So what are some of the key things that they would have to do to get this off the ground?
Well, I try and say that there are kind of opportunities and dangers here. I think that there is a real danger of thinking that you can win back the country, certainly at the national level, the presidential level, by scolding people who voted for Donald Trump and telling them either that they've been very stupid or that they have supported someone very wicked. And I think I was worried by some of the sort of posters and tone of the placards that I saw on the march that I went to the day after the inauguration in Washington, D.C., where people really seemed to be kind of lining themselves up for a dialogue of the deaf. There was a lot of kind of nagging of Trump voters. Here's the thing. I think what the left has to decide is, do they think that on their own they have the numbers to win the White House again? Do they think essentially that you can rebuild the coalition that took Barack Obama to power twice if you just kind of work a bit harder on enthusiasm and on turnout and you have a candidate who might excite people more than Hillary Clinton did? I'm skeptical of that, because I think that what happened in 2016, among other things, was that Donald Trump, for good or ill, really did redraw the electoral map. And you know, you're in the Midwest. You know, you were the sort of the center of all of this, that one of the reasons Donald Trump is now president is that millions of voters switched camps. They moved, particularly voters in kind of bits of the Rust Belt in the Midwest. People who had voted for Donald Trump, for the Democrats and voted for Barack Obama in the past, or who despised both parties equally, millions of those people rolled in behind Donald Trump. I think the big question for people calling for kind of total obstructionism, total resistance, is, do you have any interest in trying to win any of those voters back, or do you just write them all off as people who we have nothing to say to. And I think that's the kind of the danger of the herbal Tea Party approach.
Yeah, and I like how you've referenced the Cook political report and this really fascinating notion of who these voters are, the Cracker Barrel voters and the Whole Foods voters, as it were.
That's right. There's a really smart piece of work that these political analysts at the Cook Political Report have done for several elections now, which is, it turns out that there are pretty few counties in America that are home to both a Cracker Barrel, a sort of country restaurant, and a Whole Foods. You have one or the other. And what's more, if you look at whether a county is a kind of Cracker Barrel county or is a county with a Whole Foods sort of high-end grocery store in it, that tells you amazingly often whether it's a Trump county or a Hillary Clinton county. And that gap has been growing bigger and bigger. I mean, Donald Trump won, I think it's 80, I have the number here, he won 76% of Cracker Barrel counties and only 22% of Whole Foods counties. Why does that matter? Why is that more than a talking point? Why does it matter that that gap has got so big? Well, one of the problems is, you know, when political arguments around things like, you know, what's the right rate of tax? You know, I have my number, you have your number. You can compromise on a number in between. But if in fact you're saying your way of life, the food that you eat, the truck that you drive, whether you like hunting, what you think of guns, what you think of gay marriage, what you think of foreigners, if you're saying you and I have nothing in common, and maybe we think of each other as kind of bad people who don't love the country enough in our own respective ways, there's not a lot of common ground there.
There's also from the march that you covered, I was struck by Michael Moore, the activist and filmmaker who got up and basically said, listen, the Democratic Party needs new leadership completely. The old guard has to go. Does that play into this as well?
I think it does. And in fact, you can talk to sort of members of Congress who in private will say, just look at the age of the leaders of the Democratic Party in Congress. If you look at the Democratic leaders in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, if you look at Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader in the House, they're both in their 70s. If you look one level down, the kind of the second, third ranking Democrats are in their 70s. I mean, this is, you know, if the Democratic Party were a kind of big company, you would have business journalists saying they've got a kind of succession crisis on their hands. And there is a sense that the party doesn't have a kind of obvious leader. I think the core of what worries me is this idea that you can try and convince Trump voters. You either write them off, you think they're kind of beyond sort of talking to because they disagree with you on climate change or gay marriage or all those things, or you conclude that you can just kind of tell them that they're stupid and don't understand their own interests, that they're voting against their own interests, and at some point they will realize how silly they've been and they will come back home. Well, that's not how politics works. You can't scold and nag people into changing their political opinions. You have to engage with them and listen to them on their level.
You bring up a good point about the how they voted and why they voted. Is there a potential here if the Democrats do get their act together and do form sort of this herbal tea party, combined with maybe these voters not getting what they were promised eventually, because Trump really has promised a lot, that this could actually swing the other way in a big way?
Well, a lot of people may be listening who are kind of saying that I'm, you know, overselling the crisis that faces the Democratic Party. I'm sure they're currently shouting at the radio that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by 3 million votes. She came really close. You know, it was only a few counties in a few Midwestern states. You know, what is this guy talking about? Well, here's the problem. Yes, Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote by nearly 3 million votes. But if you look at the popular vote in across all of the states, she actually didn't do so well. She actually did worse than Barack Obama in 34 states. And she really did worse than him in the swing states, the dozen or so swing states that actually decided this election. The reason she got that gigantic popular vote advantage in the end is that she did really, really well in states that she was always going to win, like California or New York or Massachusetts. You look at the map of America, and the Democrats are in their worst position when it comes to governors, when it comes to who controls state legislatures, since the 1920s. They don't control either chamber of Congress in Washington. Now we've got this new nomination to the Supreme Court. the Republicans or conservatives control the Supreme Court. They have three branches of federal government, and they control basically 33 of the 50 states. You know, this is not an easy hole to climb back out of.
Yeah, and all you have to do is look at that electoral map, which really matters in this country. Lots of red on that map.
That's right. Illinois is a classic example of a state where the Democrats are the party of people. So, you know, where the people are clustered in big cities, obviously in your case in Chicago and Cook County, that's where a lot of votes are. So that gives, you know, Illinois a lot of Democratic votes. But you look at who's the party of territory and space, it's just acres and acres and miles of red. Once you get into rural areas and less urban areas, this is a very conservative country.
David, very interesting topic here. Thank you for being with us on the opening bell this morning.
Pleasure.
David Rennie is the Washington Bureau Chief, Lexington columnist for The Economist. You can check out his stories at economist.com and follow him on Twitter at DSO Rennie.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
552. Welcome back to the program this morning on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. Dow futures are up 33. NASDAQ up 25. S&P futures up about 4.5. Crude oil is trading at $53.08 a barrel. European markets are still open. All of the arrows are pointing up with, looks like the DAX leading the way in Germany, up almost 111 points, almost a full percent this morning. The CAC in France up almost a full percent as well. The latest now in agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Yesterday, the U.S. Department of Agriculture released one of the two cattle inventory reports they do throughout the year. It happens twice a year, and that report put the total number of cattle in the U.S. at 93.5 million head. That's up 1.1% from a year ago and above the average analyst estimate of 93 million a year ago. But the report shows a larger year-on-year number of beef and milk cows that have had calves, suggesting the herd is still expanding. Rich Allen, analyst at Allendale, said the report is a rebuke of the statement that we are in liquidation. This pushes off the expected bottom in cattle prices for another year. So at the end of the day yesterday, we saw the February live cattle contract down 57 cents. We saw the March feeder cattle contract down $1.35, but hog futures were higher, up $2 yesterday in the February lean hog contract. It ended the day at $69.07. Not much action in the grain market yesterday. We saw corn and wheat firm because of bargain buying and a retreating dollar as well. And March soybeans up 1.75 cents at 10.24 and a half a bushel. Today, Nashville, Tennessee, National Cattlemen's Beef Association convention gets underway. And tomorrow, the Wisconsin Corn Soy Conference in Wisconsin Dells, and I'll be there to speak on Friday. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. Now the Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for this February 1st, 2017. Today is Wednesday. A couple of things that we're watching today, and an aura of expectation hangs over the investment community as Federal Reserve policymakers get set later today to announce whether interest rates will be raised. We do not think that will happen. Thinking is the central bank will leave interest rates alone at this week's policy meeting. One thing board members have considered is that the economy, despite disappointing growth reports, has registered several gains in key areas. The Fed will likely signal that it wants additional time to monitor the progress of the economy, and it'll envision a gradual pace of rate increases ahead, perhaps two or three. They're starting to get their ducks in a row, though, for further rate hikes. It'll be too soon to pull the trigger today, according to one analyst. The Fed's two-day meeting will end in the early afternoon with a policy statement that will be studied for any signals of outlook or intentions that all could drive the markets today. One other note, yesterday Apple reported its earnings for the fourth quarter of the year. Shares in Apple are up about 3% this morning before the opening bell on Wall Street. The company reported $78.4 billion in the last quarter, sales of that in the fourth quarter. That's a new record high for the company. The CEO of Apple, Tim Cook, credited the surge partly to especially strong demand for iPhone 7 Plus, the larger and pricier iPhone model. The latest iPhone was thought to get a bump in recent months from the massive recall of Samsung's Galaxy Note 7 over that exploding battery issue. More earnings today and tomorrow.